Hey everyone, Nick Larson here, host of the Birdshot Podcast, the show that brings you conversations, stories, and traditions from all across the uplands. The Birdshot Podcast is presented by Onyx Hunt and supported by folks just like you via our Patreon community. If you want to stay up to date and not miss any of our upcoming episodes, be sure to subscribe and follow the show in your podcast player or on YouTube, wherever you're listening or watching today. Tap that button for me. Thank you for doing so. And with that said, let's get into today's conversation on the Birdshot Podcast. Welcome back, everyone, to another episode of the Birdshot Podcast presented by Onyx Hunt. Today, I am excited to be joined once again by one of our favorite guests when the subject matter turns to side-by-side shotguns. That would be avid upland bird hunter and author of the traditional side-by-side part 1 and 2, Doug Stewart. Welcome back to the show, buddy.
Well, I'm glad to be back.
And we are definitely glad to have you back. We're going to talk side-by-side shotguns today, of course, as well as bird hunting, bird dogs, and anything else that might come across our minds this morning. But it's great to have you on the show. It is early. Well, gosh, we're getting closer to mid-January at this point when you and I are chatting, which is hard to believe, really. The sun has officially set on ruffed grouse season here. Whether or not I'm officially done is still TBD. But how about out your way? You're in Colorado, right?
Yes. And the seasons run through the end of January for at least like pheasant and quail.
Okay.
And I'll get out hopefully two more times. We usually head to this time to Nebraska. And then if I still haven't gotten enough, we'll head down to New Mexico and chase some quail around.
Okay. When's the last time you've made it down to New Mexico? Is that an annual trip or not necessarily every year?
Well, it used to always be an annual trip, but now it's about every 2 years. And of course, I like to go down there and chase the gambles quail and the scaled quail.
Have you hunted Arizona and New Mexico?
You know, I have gotten to Arizona a little bit, but that's been years. So usually I don't have that much time, so I just stick to New Mexico.
Okay. I'm kind of curious. Those are obviously two states that come up when it comes to like this time of year, Southwest quail hunting, that sort of thing. And it seems like Arizona gets mentioned a lot, and I don't know if that's specifically because of the Mearns quail. I really don't know enough about it anyways. I haven't been down there to hunt, but I know they both have a lot of public land, and they're both kind of destination states for later season quail stuff.
Well, it is because you get the warmer weather, and yeah, we're cold up here and kind of done with everything, and then their seasons bleed into February. And then look at, you got how many different species of quail you can hunt there, like you mentioned, the Mearns. And in a fairly, you know, close area, you get to hunt the scaled quail and some gambles.
Yeah.
So that's the joy of it.
Do you keep a finger on the pulse of, like, quail reports and stuff? Because I could say I talk to people and hear enough stuff that I don't think expectations were super high this year for Mearns quail. But, again, it's pretty far from my backyard, and I'm only going on what I hear from listeners and customers and that sort of thing.
Well, you've been spot on. I've heard the same thing about Mearns. And then Bob King gives me reports all the time, and that's out of Santa Fe, and he's in New Mexico. And I guess the quail's actually really pretty good, at least on gambles.
Okay.
In New Mexico, in that part of the region.
Yeah. We've got one customer in particular at Upland Gun Company that he's down there, and he's always, in fact, just yesterday, he sent me a picture of his first double with his new shotgun. So he was pretty thrilled, and as were we, but mainly I'm just jealous that he's still out there chasing birds.
He is. And you got to, when you're an upland bird hunter, you know, I start up north and just keep working my way south as the season goes, you know.
What would a Nebraska hunt look for you like this time of year? Not where you would go, but you're chasing quail. What are you after?
Well, I do. I earlier in this season, I like to chase pheasant, and I got an area that's, you know, 4 hours from here. I really like to chase pheasant.
Okay.
And then I do, you're right, I start switching to quail. Me and my wife have been pinpointing some places we want to go chase down some quail. Southern Colorado is excellent for, it's kind of a hidden gem too, if you know where to go. And so we're going to hit a little bit of the quail. And I'm talking Southern Colorado because I can make that a day hunt, you know.
Yeah, okay. Where exactly in Colorado are you?
So I'm in Loveland, Colorado.
Oh yeah, that's right.
So, I mean, I do have to travel. I'm still traveling, 3 hours because it's Southern Colorado where I end up finding some bobwhite quail. And I'm not going to give it away, but the big regions like around Lamar and stuff, just I'm talking in a big circle, you know.
We definitely don't want we don't want specific spots, but it's fun to plan and daydream at this point.
It is.
What did the early season look like for you? Have you I don't know that you've at least I haven't heard from you, but have you made it out to the Grouse Woods in recent years?
I did. I go every year.
Oh, okay.
And I used to always go to Minnesota, as you well know, with our friend Jerry.
Yep.
And I haven't been there for some years because, I'm great friends with Jerry, but I happen to have a very good friend that I can just go stay with up in Michigan.
Oh yeah, that's right. Yeah, you've been going to Michigan.
And he's getting older and he's a great friend. And so we've been just heading up to Sagola, Michigan. And we did this year. We did woodcock and grouse, and the grouse numbers seemed really down. They were harder to find. The woodcock was everywhere.
Okay, yep.
We sit around the campfire at night and we usually cook up a batch of them, and it's so euphoric and it's just a good old tradition.
But yeah, your experience in the Grouse Woods sounds pretty similar to a lot of what I heard and saw this year. The grouse numbers were not what they were the last couple of years, and there did seem to be more woodcock this year, so that was my experience as well.
Yeah, and it was enjoyable. And I'm just a traditionalist. I'm getting older and I don't like to kill a lot of birds. I don't take more than I need. It's just more about the beauty and scenery. You're walking the bird in the woods. You're doing a very traditional thing with your traditional gun. And, I get to hunt with my wife, so it's like these little mini vacations for us. And
How long has your wife been hunting now, alongside you?
I believe now we've been hunting for about 13 years together.
Okay.
And she's getting really the same way I am about it. She loves the bird dogs and the country, all the different states we go. And,
Yep.
we get a really neat little place to stay in, usually rent a little house in a little town close by. And she enjoys the whole thing.
Yeah, I know she always comes up in our conversations, and when you send me pictures, it's usually the two of you. And but I don't know that we've ever really dove into it. But did she have any exposure to hunting and that's and bird dogs? And she's gotten into the bird dogs too. I remember last time we were talking about how she's kind of taken the lead on like training and doing a lot of that stuff. But did she have any exposure to it before, or was it just something like being adjacent to you and your passion for it, you just kind of got curious about it.
Well, yeah. I have a really funny story about this evolution in my second book, okay?
Okay.
And when I met her, she had moved out here from California to get all away from all the, crime and terrible stuff in California. And she was like a tree hugger. And I mean, I almost didn't date her because when I heard you're from California, because I was like, oh man, she's gonna hate guns. And
Yeah.
so I just had to, explain things to her and get her real involved with dogs because she had never had a bird dog, but she was fascinated by them. So I just lured her into it by watching Hunting with Hank with Des Young. And
Oh.
so that's how I kind of got her into it. And then when she started loving the bird dogs, she'd go out and just run the bird dogs and not even shoot. And now people think I'm really strange and kind of not much of a man's man because I kind of keep my mouth shut and I let my wife run the bird dogs. I mean, she runs the remote and it's her thing and she's commanding them. And I'm just sitting there just, the only remote I really run is the TV remote. And so this got her into it and I'm fine with that.
Yeah.
And so it just kind of worked out and evolved. And now she's probably more passionate wanting to go than me. So it's, I hope more people can get their wife involved, and if not, at least a family member or a close friend.
Yeah. And that's kind of why I was asking about that. Curious. Yeah, it's interesting. And obviously, again, I've seen the smile on her face when you send me the picture, so clearly she's into it. I have another question about that, but when you are running the TV remote, what are you watching, Doug? You don't, I don't know. You don't come across to me like a sports guy, but I could be way off. I don't know.
Nick, you're pretty good because I'm not a sports guy. I can't sit for hours watching a game. And of course, I like my hunting stuff, but I'm kind of more of a guy that'll be on that travel channel,
Okay.
the history channel. That's just kind of me. And I really like crime investigations, things that make me think. I just kind of got that kind of mind.
Yeah, that tracks. I mean, you're a traveling upland bird hunter. You love traditional vintage guns, so all that tracks, buddy.
And I'm getting bugged about it worse the older I get. I mean, I sent you pictures like on opening day. It was really a crazy thing is I love my 410 when I grew up when I was a kid, and it's just traditional, and I got me a cute little one, and a little English William Evans. It's 3 pounds, 15 ounces. It's ridiculous, okay?
Jeez, 3 pounds, 15 ounces.
And it measures 3/4 of an inch across the firing pin center. It's as small of a frame they ever made for a 410. But it is the cutest little thing. And I said, well, I'm going to challenge myself. And I started practicing with it to see if I can shoot it. And my wife has this dinner planned. She's like, honey, I'm going to go to work. You go shoot some doves, and I'll have a real nice dinner today. I'll grill up some dove poppers. We're going to have a glass of wine, sit on the back patio table. And I said, okay, I'm going to be real traditional. I still have some old paper rolled 410 shells from when I was a kid. They're a little 2.5 inch. Green Remington 7.5 shot. I even brought those. And I started to question myself. And I got out there at this little 410 before the sun came up. And I'm sitting in this brush pile I like to. And it's right next to this wide opening spot in the ditch. And the doves will come in and get a drink. Well, first couple pair of doves came in just as the sun was coming up, still a little dark out. And I heard them and didn't see the darn things. And so I walked over to the water and they flushed up and I got jumpy and I jumped and I missed 2 shots in a row at these doves with this little 410. And then I started questioning myself. I was like, oh man, I should have brought, I'm not going to be bringing dinner home tonight with my wife. I mean, we might have to order a pizza. So I'd relaxed and I kept mounting it and stuff. And I said, just chill out. You just need to get a handful. And I sat out there with that little 410 and I just had the best time ever. And I relaxed and they were coming into that water hole. And I ended up shooting 6 or 8 doves. After that, I don't think I missed another shot, maybe one. And that's why I sent you that picture of that handful of doves that I'd gotten with that little 410. And I sent it to you because I thought you would laugh and say, what is this guy doing? But that's how traditional I got is I just wanted it to be, bring back memories, do something a little challenging. I didn't travel far, so it's not like, it's a big deal if I, didn't get any. So it's just all about the adventure of it and taking pictures with it, making it happen. It's like, this would have been me as a kid.
Yeah, that's cool. It's you can make it the way that you want it to be, and I mean, there's any number of things that can sort of take, I don't know, priority or precedence over the day. Whether it's, I'm gonna carry my vintage gun today, or I'm gonna try to get a bird this way or that way. It's all about the adventure, really, which I know you know, and most of the listeners know too.
It is. And so anyway, I thought you'd think that was kind of funny and kind of fun.
Yeah, I just went back and I'm looking at the photos now. I had to re-download them. This is a total side tangent that I won't go down, but I got a new iPhone this year, and it's doing this annoying thing where like the storage fills up and these messages disappear, and I had to re-download them, but neither here nor there. I'm looking at the little William Evans 410 and the green paper shells. That's a nice gun. That's still got like, would you say that's got like remaining case colors on it? I mean, it looks like they're there.
They are, and are very muted, of course. But you can tell, hey, good eye. That's an expert there, boy.
Hey, well, I've this has got to be like the fourth time I've interviewed you, so I've learned a couple things, Doug.
Oh, you're amazing. And I also had sent you pictures in that group of my next hunt, which happened to be in Wyoming for
That's
Hungarian
where
partridge and
I'm going
suckers.
next. Yeah,
Well,
that's where I'm going next. But actually, before we go there, I'll ask you about that next, because I did want to kind of get a season recap from you. But go back through some of the details on this little William Evans 410, because I'm looking at it now. How long are the barrels on it?
so yeah, that's why it's so ridiculously light. They're 26 inch.
26, okay.
And it's hard to tell from the picture unless you look at the size of the shotgun shells and the doves. I mean, it is the most petite little 410 made in 1937. And I got it from a gentleman that brought it back from England in the original dadgum case. It's got an original little Brady four 10Ks. I mean, it's been relined and restored, but it has the owner's initials on the plaque on the case, and it's the exact same initials that are in the stock oval in the gun.
Okay. Yep,
Yeah.
yep, yep.
So it's just an amazing find.
Now, did he buy that, like your friend, did he buy that over there and then import it back here, bring it back, or what was exactly the story there?
Well, he did, and he had three other 410s. He kind of has a love for 410s because he grew up with them. And he brings in cases, and he still has dual citizenship. And he brings in some gun cases and stuff. And it was the craziest thing. I met him 3 years ago at a gun show, and he was just selling some accessories and gun cases. And anyway, we got to be friends and talking because he lives in Colorado here, not too far from me.
Okay.
And yeah, I got the whole package deal. It's just kind of amazing.
Do you have a lot of 410s? Is that your only 410? I know you love the 12 gauge, which we will talk about later, but.
Yeah, my wife, believe it or not, he bought me a little Hammer 410, and I think I featured it in my first book. And it's a little London-made Vaughn, and it's a little Hammer 410, and it's got 28 and a half inch barrels. It is the cutest little thing. And I used it up there at the grouse camp because we'd always have a 410 day. Once we shot our limits of something, man, we switched to 410s and the challenge was on. And I kind of, that was a tradition with WJ when I was up there.
Oh yeah, yep.
Oh, yeah. And I did break down and I traded some Parkers a little while back
Uh-oh.
with, I know, with Connecticut because I wanted a couple Parkers and I had plenty of them. And I got a little Christian Hunter 410.
Okay.
And the Americans never made a true 410, as you well know. They were putting them on 28 gauge frames like Ithaca,
Yeah, you don't see a lot of 3 pound, 15 ounce 410s out there.
And this actually, theirs has 13 16th of an inch between the firing pin centers. So it is smaller than a 28, because a 28's 15 16ths, okay.
Is that like kind of the true way to measure like the frame size is what's between the firing pins?
It is because everything else is built around it.
Okay.
And that's the scale of the frame. So you measure between the firing pin centers, like a 20 gauge is 1 inch.
Yeah, that makes sense. Do you have a chart on that in your book?
My second book, I don't. I did mention it and talk about it, though, in writing. I didn't put a chart, but I talked about it.
Okay.
I said, like, a 20 gauge is an inch, a 16 gauge is an inch and 16.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. I didn't recall that, but yeah, you should put that in book number three, 'cause I frame size is one of these things that gets, and I see it from both sides now. I used to be sort of the consumer that would, I knew enough to know, like, to ask the question, is that a real 28 gauge frame or is it on a 20 gauge frame? But I didn't really know what that meant, and I think that's still quite common, because I mean the need to know is kind of, depending on what you're looking for, it's maybe not that relevant. But really, frame size is one thing, but it's you're looking at the whole package, the weight of the gun, the feel in your hand. It doesn't necessarily mean it's a good thing or a bad thing. If you're looking for a true scaled 410 gun because you want that, that's one thing. But a 410 on a 28 gauge frame isn't necessarily a bad thing. It's just something to know, and that frame size thing. The measurement is interesting to me.
Well, it is to me too, because you obviously have a lot more handwork in the smaller frame, and the gun's just going to be a little bit more elegant and dainty, and the fences are going to bulge a little bit more around the frame and make it look more like a scaled down 12 gauge,
Right,
right?
right. Yeah, and those are that's a good one to point out, that like the subtle nuance, if you don't know what to look for or what you're looking for, you're not going to pick up on that. But I think when if you saw one next to the other, a scaled frame where the fences really do bulge out from the frame, that's what sort of gives it that elegant look, where like the frame is smaller than the profile of the barrels, and it's if you looked at one side by side, I bet you could see it. But if you didn't know what to look for, you probably wouldn't notice it.
Right. And it's also telling me about a little bit more that went into the gun as far as, craftsmanship and manufacturing. So that really matters to people that are really deep into this stuff,
So anyways, yeah, the front you I totally sidetracked us there when you mentioned the distance between the firing pins. That's interesting.
Yeah, and it's something I don't know. I pay attention to all that kind of stuff.
That much is clear with two books in the bank and perhaps number three on the horizon. We know you're a nut for this stuff, Doug, so that's why we ask you. Now, what am I looking at in the photos of the 410, the William Evans 410? I see the green paper shells, but then what are those metal cases or metal shells?
Well, of course, me being who I am, I found some old brass 410 shells, and they're preloaded brass 410 shells, and I've got those in my case. And I mean, this thing has got the full William Evans accessories, a William Evans stamped oil bottle in it, snap caps, little tiny 410 cleaning rods, everything. So, of course, I had to have some old brass shells.
That's like the whole kit and caboodle. Like when you buy a vintage gun, if it's got the maker's case, it needs the little oil, the
Yep.
oil thing, the snap caps and the cleaning rods. That's everything.
Yeah, and I made sure like my oil bottle stamped, made from England on the bottom. I mean, it's just the real deal.
Okay, so that brass shell that I'm looking at, that's like actually crimped.
Yep.
Is that like what's up with that? Like, is that a one-time use you shoot out of that, or what is that?
No, you can reload it many times. You just
Wow,
recrimp
really?
it. Yeah. Little one of those little hand crimpers that you put on the side of your bench. Workbench in the garage, I've got one.
Wow, I have not I'm not super familiar with that. I can crimp my 28 gauge shells and my little Mech Size Master Junior, but that's about it. I've never done anything with the
Yeah,
brass.
and you're right. Even most brass, you see, I wouldn't say most, but a lot of them are roll crimped.
Yeah,
And I believe the other shell laying next to it is actually roll crimped. Yeah.
Yeah, that's got a smooth edge to it. But yeah, man, that's interesting.
It's just fun stuff, and I don't know. I like stuff like that.
Yeah. So your next hunt, the next photos that you sent me, you were chucker hunting, did you say? Or kind of looks like almost looks like blue grouse territory.
Well, believe it or not, this is why. This is in Wyoming. I mean,
Okay.
we're right next to the Bighorn River. We walk down and let the dogs get in the Bighorn River. So this scenic is just out of control. And we did a pheasant hunt in that field.
Oh, really?
All right. So if you're looking at the right picture. Because I might have sent you a picture of when I was up there blue grouse hunting too.
Yeah, I think I might be looking at the
And if I'm in that
dusky
flannel shirt, I was
stuff.
carrying my 410 because I also took my 410
Yep.
blue grouse hunting.
Yep.
So then the next photos are Wyoming.
Okay.
And I hunted pheasants down there next to the Bighorn River.
Oh, yeah, now I can see that. Yep.
And it was just the coolest thing ever because I met a really good friend through my books, okay? And he's bought a lot of guns from me. And he's from Kentucky and just a sweet guy. I mean, he's a God-fearing, believing guy like I am. And he's a veteran and he's all into bird hunting now. And we've become good buddies and he's never been on a Western bird hunt. And he really trusts me on everything. I said, well, would you be willing to hop a plane and come out and meet me? Because he's in Kentucky. I'll bring a gun because he's been talking about buying another gun from me. And he wants a good English sidelock. And he's a real small guy like me. I mean, he's 5 foot 6. I'm probably 5'7" now. I used to be 5'8". And so our builds, we look like brothers standing next to each other. So he's found that my guns fit him perfect. And he's been really wanting to go the Churchill route, but he's been a little bit like, I don't know. Everybody says you got to have long barrels. I said, well, you're a little man. You don't need long barrels on a little man. But anyway, I have a real nice 25 inch sidelock. I said, how about I bring that out there and you meet me in Wyoming and I can pick you up and we'll go on this bird hunt. So it's just an adventure. So he met me out there and it's at Arthur Hill. It's an Arthur Hill and Son. Beautiful little sidelock. It's built on a 16 gauge frame. It weighs 5 pounds, 15 ounces, Churchill rib, everything. And I said, this was my first, Churchill sidelock until I got one. That guy outshot me. He shot so dadgum good on this trip and he'd never shot pheasants before ever. So that's why I wanted to introduce them to it. But then the main thing, because we were going to stay there a few days, is we were hunting Hungarian partridge. We were going to get into some of the rock outcroppings and, hunt chuckers. So he got all three birds in this hunt. And we almost added sage grouse to it. But we just had an absolute blast. And by the second day, I think it was, my shooting really went down. And I've had a lot of shoulder problems and mounting my gun. And man, this guy just shot great. The last day was pouring rain, and he got one bird off of his limit. And this is on just going out in the morning in the pouring rain. And he did what I said. He's an advocate in my second book. I said, as soon as that gun hits your shoulder, it needs to be going off. I said that your gun's already swinging, tracking the bird before you get it to your shoulder. And when it hits your shoulder, I want you to shoot. And we talked about it. He goes, man, as long as I do exactly what you said. Yeah, and he was shooting birds up in these canyons, and he did an incredible job. And so then he was sold on this gun. He goes, yeah, it didn't make any difference. He goes, I didn't see the gun. I never even thought about the gun. I just stared at the bird. And he goes, as long as I didn't think about anything and I just swung and bang, he goes, I was hitting everything. So it was ecstatic. And I mean, we got pizza one night, our room, and we came in, and I had a gun laid out on the coffee table. I had a Charles Lancaster 1220 sitting there because we're obsessed with these little bird guns. And we looked at it and ate our pizza and had a cocktail. And this is how this hunting trip went. Best time of our lives.
The gun over your shoulder, with you and your wife, that Churchill with the barrel engraving, that's your Churchill.
Yeah, so that's my Churchill Premier, which was their
Okay.
top of the line side lock. Yeah.
I mean, that thing, I think you might have said it's a pretty nice gun. That would might be the understatement. That's a beauty.
It's as good as a gun ever made. It was their top of the line. It's an assisted opener, the whole nine yards, you know.
When was that made?
So that one was made in 1937.
Okay.
Yep.
Gosh, it just looks phenomenal. I mean, it's got a killer piece of wood on it. The barrel engraving's really, really cool. That is a beautiful, beautiful gun.
Yeah, it's kind of my best gun because, as you well know, I really like Churchills.
Yep.
It's not obviously about the 25-inch barrels, but the gun's beautifully balanced. It's lightweight. It works good for me with my build. And it's a lightweight upland bird gun. I mean, they're all about 6 pounds, so I can carry it forever.
Yeah. I think you, I mean, again, you would know better. You've handled and shot a lot more of these guns than I have, but the barrel length thing, I mean, there's certain things to consider, but it is about proportions too. It's like your length of pull and your stature as a shooter. So it's not necessarily a one size fits all. Like I have to have 30-inch barrels, but I'm 6 foot, 15-inch length of pull. And on my little 28 gauge, I love the 30-inch barrels,
You
but,
got to.
Yeah, and I need it really because of the central balance. Like I just feel like I have everything to gain with having a little bit more barrel length. But another gun like your Churchill that has 25-inch barrels and is perfectly balanced and fit to you. I mean, that's yeah. They come in all shapes and sizes.
If you're willing to bird walk for a second, because this is part of what we keep getting questions about, right?
Yeah.
Is honestly, and we're going to talk about it, obviously, there's a totally different gun between sporting clays and upland bird gun, okay?
Yeah.
Now, you take a kid and a BB gun's just perfect for them. It fits them, they're, 6 years old, the weight's perfect, everything. But if I grab that thing, it's a pistol. Well, like I said, I'm a 175-pound man. I'm not very tall. I got short arms. I'm muscular and lean, but that gun fits me. And in the uplands, for me, I don't want to be swinging around a 30-inch barrel. It's banging the car, getting it out of the car. To me, it just doesn't feel like it matches up the stock length and my build, okay?
Yep.
And so I'm really good anywhere between 25 and 28 is great for me for the field. Somebody your height, you might be phenomenal anywhere from 28 to 30. And it kind of makes sense. And my guns, what people don't understand is they think that you got to have all this weight in the barrels. And you very well, it is pretty good if you're swinging on a bunch of fast pashes and doves. And definitely if you're shooting sporting clays, because that dadgum gun is sitting against your shoulder. So the gun has no weight. So you're relying on the barrels to give you all the weight to swing it. When I'm walking and I shoot at a bird, my gun's down at my waist. And so I swing the gun up. So the entire weight of the gun is what's given me momentum. I'm not relying on just the weight of the barrels. And I shoot the minute it gets to my shoulder. I'm not riding the bird out at all. So the barrel length, the weight all up the front doesn't matter. And if I ride that bird out for a while, I'm going to, then it matters. So, I mean, Churchill's was the most popular gun in the 1930s, and they sold more of them than anybody. And not everybody back then was a bad shot. And I keep reading some new readers that say, oh, you may as well forget hitting a bird if you got. You have less than 30-inch barrels, you need long barrels. I was like, well, I'll take these guys out and I'll educate them. But normally you are going to get more weight with a longer barrel because they're probably heavier. But with English guns, not necessarily. I've had some pretty light 30-inch barrels that the weight's still on the hinge pin of the gun. And so really what matters is the weight of the entire gun when you're upland bird hunting. You might need 6 pounds of momentum in general in your gun. If you're a big man, you might like, dude, I got to have it 6.5 pounds. Well, yeah, it's a very individualized thing. So it's light.
Yep.
To you, but the gun needs to be manageable and smooth. And that's why I like English guns so much, is because usually they distribute the weight and the gun just feels smoother to me. Even when it's light, it's smoother and it don't start bobbling and bouncing and getting whippy, which I can't stand.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah. That's kind of what you're trying to protect against. If you, you know, if you have a gun that has the weight, if it has short barrels and then it has the weight in the wrong place, you know, that's not, you know, you're not going to get the best results. Same thing with if you've got too long of barrels and too much weight out front for upland bird hunting, you might find yourself in a similar situation.
Well, exactly. So I really, you know, and I've got ways of figuring out with people, and they need to do what's great for them. But they do have to realize that it's two different guns, an upland bird hunting gun where you're walking and you're shooting instinctively, you step forward, swing and bang, compared to when that gun's sitting on your shoulder and you're saying, pull, waiting for a pigeon to come out.
Yeah.
Totally different guns and you're shooting them differently. And I get it. I mean, if I was shooting sporting clays, I'd want the barrels probably 30 inches all day long. If I was a bigger man, maybe even 32, you know?
Yeah, there's a reason that trend is in play, I'm sure. But I notice it a lot, like when I do wear my GoPro and I look back, like, you know, you shoot a bird and you sort of have a image in your mind of how it went. I'm oftentimes surprised at like just how much momentum and speed I generate in my swing and the follow through, where like I didn't intentionally follow through, and my guns are not barrel heavy. They're very centrally balanced, but it's just that instinctive shooting, the mount, as you say, going from basically ready position to shooting, you build in all that speed and that momentum. And I'm often surprised that like I'll see like where I pull the trigger and then where I continue to push the barrels through on that flight path as I swing through the bird. And like, it almost seems like it's like, I don't even think I was capable of doing that, but it's just interesting to watch it back in slow motion, I guess.
It is. And I go through it, you know, step by step in my second book to the T. And I'm going to tell you that if the bird jumps up and it's flying fast, you instinctively will swing your gun and jerk your gun faster and everything. I mean, it's human nature. And that's that built-in lead that's very accurate, because your eyes are accurate. Okay, so your eyes really have it. And they're going to swing.
Unless you do something silly like look at the bead or look at your muzzles. You know, you got to keep your eyes on the bird.
And that's another thing, is a lot of people say, well, I need a super long sighting plane. No, you should never even see your gun barrel, okay? So why does it have to be, well, why is the length an issue for that? Well, in sporting clays, some people even aim their gun and they do use it as a little bit more of a plane, and they might look at it and get their plane going, and then they might say pull and then look at the pigeon, the clay pigeon. So it's kind of a different deal, and they are using it as a sighting plane. So you just know another difference between an upland bird gun and a sporting clays gun.
Yeah.
And so it's all very relative, and I shoot the guns that work for my frame and fit. And I don't know about you, but, you know, I trounce around for days out there and the miles I put in is ridiculous. And I've got to have a light bird gun that I can carry and that is just super comfortable in my hand. And I don't have to think about, you know, mechanically swinging it around.
Yeah. When the topic of weight, you know, weight is a popular one to think about. And I think you can get carried away talking about the exact weight of a gun versus how the overall gun feels and where that weight is distributed. Sometimes more important, but do you have a preference for what you like as a weight of gun?
Well, you know, I kind of adapt and practice. Like I told you, I took out that little 410 and I struggled. It's just ridiculous, but that was the challenge. But that's not what I'm going to take on a lifetime trip where I'm really trying to, you know, get something, and I've traveled umpteen miles, right? So I really do my most consistent and best around 6 pounds. Me personally, most gentlemen are bigger than me, and they might do better at 6.25 pounds, maybe 6.5. Now, don't get that caught up in weight, like you said, because I've got a I got a lot of Churchills. I got a 6.5 pound Churchill, and it don't feel 6.5 pounds at all. That thing is fat. But it's the way it's balanced, and they need to be comfortable to carry. But that's why I like English guns so much, is because I think they paid more attention to the balance of the gun than most makers. And balance means the most to me. Okay. Some other people, it's other things. It's the design. It's maybe how tough and reliable it is, but I like balance. And that's why a lot of people say that an English side lock is the best balance guns usually, because it distributes the weight more and they feel a little smoother in your hands in general. But that's not to say, you can get a box lock that they did a really well job of balancing it also. Absolutely. I always pull out a gun and I put it on the coffee table, you know that, when I talk to you, and whatever I think is just a phenomenal little Upland bird gun. And I just got myself a little Charles Daly, and it's a featherweight, and it's a Prusa made in Germany, 1907. This little 12 gauge is built on a 16 gauge frame, and it weighs 5 pounds 11 ounces. The original two and
What's
five
that
eighths
chambered
tube,
in?
2 5/8. And I looked it up because you know how they stamp the proof marks different in every country. And I looked it up, and this has got the same proof mark stamps as a modern 2 3/4 inch nitro 12 gauge. It's unbelievable. And it is just the daintiest, lightest, cute thing, but it's balanced very well. They hit the nail on the head with this little Charles Daly.
Love it.
I thought you'd think that was pretty neat.
Yeah, did you have you had a chance to hunt with that one yet?
No, I haven't. This is the newest
Okay.
edition, and I used to have a
Nice.
little Charles Daly that was a featherweight 16 gauge, and I should have never sold it. I sold it to Steve Barnett way back when he was
Oh
alive, of
yeah.
course, years ago. And I've always been kind of looking for one, and I just got a good deal on one from an 80-year-old gentleman in Alaska, and he's an avid upland bird hunter, and I couldn't pass this up. They're too hard to find.
You said something earlier that you had a bad shooting day when you were on the trip with your buddy, or you started shooting poorly. And I at that moment I wanted to ask you, when you have an off day or afternoon or what do you think's going on? Because it's, you could sit here and tell me like all the things you got to do. It's like any of these sort of mental performance sports, golf, the archery, shooting, like we know what to do, but we don't always do it in the moment. Like, what do you think is happening when you're having an off day, Doug?
Well, what happened to me is, I got a torn bicep tendon. And after I mount a gun too much, my shoulder hurts so bad I can't lift my right arm up. So I'm not getting my gun to my face. But when I have a bad shooting day, usually what happens is I miss a shot, which I don't do a lot. And then it drives me nuts and I start thinking about it.
Yeah.
And I start subconsciously thinking about, hey, did I mount my gun right? Did I step forward and lean into the shot with my left foot the way you're supposed to? And then when you start thinking about it, you're done. Because I know how to shoot a shotgun. I should practice it at home. And then after that, it's totally autotelic. So the best thing I can do is just relax. Don't think about it again. Don't keep trying to mount my gun. Just trust myself and relax and laugh it off and say, I don't give a crap. Laugh about it. But if I try to correct it and I just start thinking about it and what am I doing wrong, and then you're done. And then it's not instinctive shooting anymore.
Yeah.
Does that make
In
sense?
hockey, in hockey, they would call that gripping the stick too tight. You know, you're
Yeah,
trying too hard.
exactly. And I know you've
Yeah.
been there.
Yep. Oh yeah. Yeah. I'm definitely asking from experience there, because it is one of the, I've had good stretches and bad stretches. This year, I had them both. I had some really good stretches of where I felt like I was just effortlessly, connecting on the shots, and then at times you don't. And I do think, nine times out of 10, it's a bad gun mount. It's like something about the flush, or usually what I'm most susceptible to is just any given scenario, bird gets up and I rush and basically am shooting before I didn't make a complete gun mount, and my head is probably floating over the stock. Didn't get to the stock, and I just didn't get a clean mount, and I shot and missed basically.
That's a great exclamation because I'm the same way. And when I start putting that conscious effort into it, you're done. I want it to all happen subconsciously. But so that's why I practice mounting my gun in the house before I go to where it's just hitting the right spot every time. I turn some
Yeah.
different angles and I get in a groove and I get some muscle memory. And then when you go out there, it goes great. But when you haven't been doing that and you get spooked, I mean, the bird just freaks you out, you know. And you lose your mind for a minute and you throw your gun up and you shoot and you're like, wait a minute. I shot off the hip that way before because I'm so freaked out. And it's like, you know, did I have it mounted? And then you're trying to look at the bird and you got your head way up in the air and it, you know, the stock's not down on the stock. And then boom, you know, you're going to shoot right over the top of it. That's what it is.
Yeah. I forget who I was talking to, but I also think I'm curious if you'll agree with this, but I think, you know, when you're doing your practice mounts, because the situation and the setting is so different, you're much more likely to, you know, mount that gun up and really get a pretty firm cheek weld on the gun. Again, because you have no distraction, you're not actually
Right.
shooting. But in practice, like when you're in the field, very rarely do you press your gun down, you press your cheek down as much as you would when you're practice mounting. So you're already susceptible to kind of floating your head because you want to see that bird so much over the barrels. And so if you stop short at all, you know, you're probably a lot further off than you even realize.
And you're totally right. And I noticed this decades ago, okay? And so this is another point, and this is human nature because the bird is rising, it's coming off the ground, and you're trying to use your peripheral vision and see everything and pick this bird up. So that's vision. And so you're wanting to keep your head up and you're doing things quickly. So you're just not as glove tight to your gun. So I like a little more drop in my stock on my upland bird guns and it works perfect. But if I'm shooting sporting clays, it's the opposite. I have less drop in the stock. That thing is glued to your chin and you're really trying to pinpoint these targets. And you're really pinpointing. You don't give a crap what's in the background. You know where it came from. You're not freaked out. You're not losing your mind and it fluttered and you jumped and your foot stance is off because you were
And
actually
you cold
walking.
pull. Yep.
Right. And so
Yep.
automatically, like you just made the best point, is that gun's not going to be as tight and you're trying to pick up everything with your eyes and you're going to, you know, you can have a little more drop in your stock and bam, you'll be just fine. And that's why a lot of older guns that were upland bird guns had more stock in them than the guns being made now that are being used more for clays, possibly dove shooting, possibly even waterfowl, than they are true upland bird hunting like I do, which is all quail and pheasants and grouse and woodcock. And there's a difference. And that's why I wrote these books. You know, I've been doing that my whole life. And I just have a passion for it. That's the only kind of hunting I do.
Well, we've discussed quite a bit about, you know, I know what you like in a gun and sort of what suits certain people. Let's transition slightly and get a sort of an update as far as like what does the landscape look like right now in buying side-by-side shotguns, vintage or otherwise. You know, I know you look at a lot of vintage guns. You know, what have you seen any trends or noticed anything recently within that market where the value is for somebody that's looking for a good upland, you know, not a collector, but they're an upland bird hunter and they're curious about this stuff.
You know, that's I like how you put that because I do. I probably get more emails than anything on how to get a cheap side by side because they're wanting to get introduced to this, but they're not like willing to go spend, you know, $5,000, $6,000 and get a good gun. And you know, I get it. I mean, the wife might just be like, "Really? You're trying something new and you spent what?" But I do want to say right off that a good side by side, I wouldn't consider any of them cheap. They're not that cheap, okay? They're a little harder to make. And you got to look at it in relativity. I mean, I wouldn't believe, can't believe all the money some of my buddies spend on golfing and stuff. But,
Right.
you know, I care, and we can go through the steps to look at this, okay? But you can find some Spanish bird guns. You'll go on the Guns International, whatever, and you're going to find some really good little box locks from AYA or one of the English makers.
Ugarte Chea. I mean, there's
Yeah.
Ugarte Chea has got some great guns out there. There's, yeah, Spanish.
Arietta.
Yep.
And the little box locks are going to range $1,500, clear up to $3,000. Okay. And there's side locks you can find a great deal once in a while for $3,500 and, you know, around the $4,000 mark. And they're going to run clear up to about $8,000 on some good side locks. And you got to realize that if you're in the Italian market, the Beretta's always made great guns, and they've got some little side-by-sides, and they're super reliable, good guns. If you're a Browning guy, the BSS are great, reliable guns. You got the Sporters, and they made a side lock too. And you're talking,
Did they really?
oh yeah, they're a little BSS side lock. You can pick those up around 5 grand, and they're amazing little guns. Great guns. And of course, they were made in Japan by the great maker, but they're good, reliable guns. We talk about CZs a little bit, and they got their little Bob White ring neck model that you can pick up for 1200 or 1500 bucks.
I would be willing to guess that, the CZ Bob White has been the gateway for so
Yeah.
many people. I mean, it's a I have one. It's a heck of a starting point if you're curious about, what the heck is this side-by-side business all about. I mean, there's few better starting points than that, I would say.
I think you're right. And I think the little Italian-made Fostis are fantastic, and they're not off the
Yeah.
chart. And of course, if you're like, no, I want a little, higher grade gun that's very affordable, I might want to even have one made for me. Then obviously the little Upland guns that you're involved in are a fantastic gun to look at. And it's not just plug-in, it's just been a fact. Now, if you're like, hey, I've got to have an American gun, then you got your Fox Sterlingwerths are cheaper, your LC Smith Field Grades, all kinds of cheaper Ithacas. The Parker, the cheapest of the Parkers you'll find is probably a Trojan. And then, of course, we're learning now, and I know that you talked to Kirby Hoyt, the English box locks that he's bringing in now are very, very affordable if you're willing to pay a couple thousand dollars. And there's some really nice dealers of those right now.
Yeah, that would be like if the CZ Bob White doesn't excite you, Kirby Hoyt's got a lot of very economical English box locks that if you're just more drawn to that historical vintage feel, there's a lot of good deals in that world, it seems like.
We named a lot of different makers and more affordable guns there that are going to be good, reliable guns, right? But if you want to talk about everybody new to the market, what they need to figure out, okay, is first of all, you kind of need to figure out your dimensions and what's going to kind of fit for a gun for you as far as the drop and the length of pull and what your preferences are in weight and barrel length. And we just talked about that, okay? Now, once you figure that out, you need to figure out what gauge you want. And then you need to figure out what choke. And I've got choke guides in my first book. And maybe it's got screw-in chokes, okay? And it's not a problem. And then you need to figure out, do I want a side lock, a box lock? Of course, you probably, if not want to spend a lot of money, you're not going to get a trigger plate. But they're phenomenal guns. They're little round body trigger plate action, like on a John Dixon. And they're some of the best balanced guns, ever, and they're Scottish.
That's permanently on my wish list.
And I got a James McNaughton 28 gauge. And it's
Wow.
unbelievable how smooth that little thing is, the distribution of the weight and how it carries the weight low, which is what I like. So you got to figure that out. And if you want to go a step further, you're getting real traditional about it, like me. You can figure out what's a reflection of your personality. Okay, like some people want a German gun because they're strong. They got a million locking devices on them. They're never going to shoot loose.
Yep.
And their engraving's a little bit more 3D and jumps out at you. And some people just dig that look. And I lean towards English guns now just because their dynamics and handling quality, and I like just subtle scroll engraving and the heritage of them. But I had a friend where I was laughing my head off because he's all into the expensive Italian guns. And they make some of the best guns in the world. I mean, the fit and finish on them is insane. And I said, well, he goes, how come you don't like those and you're not collecting those? And I said, well, first of all, some of the top dogs are crazy expensive. And some of them, for me, the engraving and stuff is just a little bit too much artwork. And I was talking about, I said, I was looking at this really nice gun and it's got a naked lady on it. And Bob pops up and he goes, Doug, he goes, when do you ever not want to look at a naked lady? And he goes, I can hunt with my gun and I'm getting to look at a naked lady all the time. And I'm like, well, That's an arguable point, I guess. Okay, so it's each his own.
Try to keep your eye on the bird with that
Oh my
ton in front
gosh.
of
All
you, though.
right. So, and maybe you're just an American traditionalist. I'll pull out a Parker when I'm doing, a lot of woodcock and grouse hunting because it's a real American heritage. It's been going on forever. You could say maybe the same in the piney woods, and
Have you ever owned a peyote or like a B. resini or anything like that?
no, I haven't.
Okay.
And of course, I've picked a lot of them up.
Yep.
And yes, the craftsmanship is the amount of polishing and fitting, and they're world class for sure.
Yeah.
That's unarguable, right? And so then you kind of figure out, what means something to me. And to me, it's all tradition. I mean, I like, old houses, and I'm just an old soul. I like an old vehicles. I mean, someday I want a really old, Toyota Land Cruiser.
Oh, don't get me started, Doug.
We'll see what I mean. So I'm just kind of an old soul.
Gosh.
And I even like this little Christian Hunter's probably just the most incredible 410. It's pinless. It's got gold washed internal parts. I mean, I can't argue.
What do you mean by pinless? I don't even know what that means.
All right, so there's no exposed pins showing
Oh,
on the receiver
yeah,
arm.
like on the side lock.
On a side lock. They're completely
Okay.
removed. It's
Okay.
completely smooth. I mean, it's just an extra
Wow.
step, right?
Yeah.
And but it's not my thing. I may end up selling it. My thing is I like old guns that were made a long time ago that are still in incredible condition and have been cared for. And they tell a story when I see muted case colors, when there's a few little scratches on it, when, there's the checkerings worn down where the hands have been held and it's darker from all the oil in your hands, and the gun just wants to hunt. It looks like it's been doing it forever. It was made for it. And I just think about all the guys that carried it before me and how many birds it's killed. So I'm just a, that's me. Okay. I'm old school and I love old
Love it.
school craftsmanship. And then I meet some younger guys that like, well, no, I want something newer and all the engravings done perfect and lasered in with lasered engraving. Well, that's fine. There's nothing wrong with that. So figure out what you like, because then you're going to enjoy looking at it as it sits in your house. You're going to enjoy it in the pictures you take out in the field. You're going to look at it while you're carrying it constantly. I mean, these are beautiful birds. I mean, why shoot them with an ugly gun?
Yeah.
So you've got to figure out all those things before you make a purchase, because then it's going to reflect you and you're going to really enjoy what you have.
I love that. I do. I that is part of the fun. Especially like the different regions. Like the English guns are different. You mentioned the German guns. Have you ever owned a Husqvarna?
I haven't.
Okay. You're familiar with those?
Absolutely. And well, I
That's a
take that back.
Swedish gun.
I'm not sure to tell you the truth. Is it
Maybe
French or?
it's Finnish. Maybe it's Finnish. I think it's. We better ask. Let's try asking ChatGPT.
Yeah, because I don't know. I mean, if you would have told me a Manufrance or a Darn or something like that, I know. But I'm not sure about
I'm
the Husqvarna.
99% sure it's Scandinavian, but
Okay.
we'll
But I've
see.
seen some with sweet little rounded frames,
Yep.
and you can pick them up very affordable.
Yeah, those are really affordable. There's a dealer. This is going, yeah, made in Sweden, specifically in the town of Husqvarna. There we go. So I never owned one, but I went through a little bit of a phase where, and it's really one of my side by side slash grouse hunting mentors. In fact, he stopped by my office yesterday. He has a lot of German guns. He's got all kinds of different guns, but he likes the German guns, JP Sowers, and
Yep.
he borrowed me a couple of his, loaned them to me at one time. And I there's a certain, not all of the German guns appeal to me,
Me neither.
but
Like,
I really appreciate their craftsmanship. And there's a certain kind of JP Sauer. You'll see it in some of the other guild guns that is more probably you would probably agree in that it's more rounded,
yeah.
kind of more sleek looking. And I love all of the fasteners. Like I love the rib extensions and not so much the greener crossbow. I like when it's a hidden third fastener and the side clips. And I get into all that stuff. But the Husqvarna guns are very much identical to the kind of JP Sauer guns that I like. And in fact, I've heard some people speculate that maybe the actions were made by JP. So I don't know exactly, but there's another guy local here that he loves Husqvarnas, and he was sending them to me for a while. I never did buy one, but they're phenomenal little guns.
Well, thanks, Nick. You brought that up because we were talking about more affordable side-by-sides that are really neat.
Yep.
And you just came up with one that people can afford if you can find one. And that's why I mentioned this little Prusa Charles Daly, because it is German, okay? But the frame is the tiniest, most gorgeous little thing. It's not like you're thinking about with some of the other German guns, okay? And the same thing with the Sawyers. I've seen, like you talking, some of them, they're real rounded and
Yep.
very elegant, and you're like, man, this is a fantastic little bird gun. And so they're out there. I mean, look at Francotts, you know?
Yes, Francotts, I love
I mean,
those as
what an
well.
incredible little, the Belgians
Yep.
had it down ages ago. I had a little Damascus 12, I should have never sold it, 12 gauge Francotts that weighed 5 pounds, 14 ounces. The original 2 5/8 inch chambers, the most beautiful Damascus you ever seen. What an incredible little bird gun. And I got it for a pretty smoking price, and it's a pre-World War I, obviously, and the quality was insane. And so that's another little gem for the dollar is a
Yeah, that's
Francotte.
probably a pro tip of the show. It's like if you get sort of carried away looking at the vintage English stuff and you kind of like what you're seeing, but the price is sort of scaring you off, that's where the Belgian Francotts, the German guns, and even these Husqvarnas, where you're getting, an extreme level of build quality at really economical prices by comparison. It's been a while since I've done the really since I have been chasing down certain vintage guns, because I kind of have certainly I have everything I need, that's for sure, but I don't have everything I want. But I haven't looked at these at I haven't used AI much to look at this stuff, but I just wanted to share this because I pulled it up on the Husqvarna guns. Husqvarna began as a Swedish state army in the 1600s and evolved into a major industrial manufacturer by the late 1800s and early mid 1900s, they were producing a wide range of sporting firearms, including side-by-side shotguns. Most vintage Husqvarna side-by-sides you see today were built entirely in Sweden, emphasized function, durability, and sensible weight, were often sold as working guns, not luxury pieces, frequently show up in 16 and 12 gauge with lean, no-nonsense lines. I would say that about perfectly describes them. They're neat little guns.
You're right, and they feel good in your hand when you carry them. And
Yeah.
yep, I know exactly. And you're right that you hit the nail on the head with what I've done there. Yep.
That's cool.
And so what's neat is we've really named some other options that people really need to consider or look at that they
Yeah.
might really like. And instead of just getting stuck on one thing, because I've got them all kinds of different makers, and I like them for different things, you know. And it's there's some amazing bird guns out there.
Yeah.
So
No doubt.
you really got to do your research instead of just buying anything. And don't worry about what somebody else is doing. This isn't a team sport. Get what you like,
Right,
what makes you
right.
feel great. There's no really right or wrong. I mean, I talked about, in one of my books, one of the best shots I was ever with was that kid from Nebraska, and he was shooting an 1897 Winchester. That pump, it's got an exposed hammer, is like it's uglier than a homemade bar of soap, okay? And this kid was just a he didn't miss a bird the whole trip. I'm talking, we were out there at least 3 days. And so yeah, if you got something you love and you shoot great, I mean you're not wrong, but definitely get something that you like and represents you. And kind of like I said, it's kind of a reflection of your personality and how you kind of view the sport
Yeah,
and the
sort
uplands.
of
I mean, look at the
the
people.
lens you want to view it through. Yeah.
Look at all the different bird dogs. I
Right,
can't tell
exactly.
somebody, I think your bird dog's just ugly and weird, and they love that bird dog, and it gets them out in the field and adds joy to them. And there's so many different kinds, and that's okay. I think it's a wonderful thing.
What you're saying, Doug, is have some fun with it, is what you're saying.
Yeah, we hunt behind our Llewellyn setters.
Yep.
And they're gorgeous and poetic, and with their tail up in the air when they're pointing, they're just sweethearts in the house and stuff. But I'll tell you one thing, they're definitely not the best hunting dogs in the world.
Uh-oh, you just made a bunch of Llewellyn setter
I
owners
did.
angry, Doug.
I know I did, but
And breeders.
I know, but we got one that won't get in the water for nothing.
Uh-oh.
One, or actually both of them are terrible about retrieving. But I'll tell you, our little Llewellyn setter, when she's running around, if she don't care about an area, don't waste your time hunting it. There's nothing there. But if she don't want to leave an area and she keeps circling it and just keeps going over it. Just let her do her thing. And as Billy will tell you, when he went out and hunted me with me in Wyoming, she will find that bird. I don't care where it is. So yeah. That's cool. You know? So yeah, I just really want people to get out there and enjoy these things, you know?
Heck yeah. Awesome, buddy. Well, that is helpful information, but also fun. I enjoyed kind of running back through some of that stuff with you for sure. Now, I know we teased it earlier, and I know you're always getting questions from listeners and people that follow you and stuff, but what might be on the horizon as far as book number three, and what story is left yet to tell, Doug?
All right. I admit, if you buy part one and two of my books, you're going to know almost everything you need to know about side by side. You know how to shoot them. In part two, I've got how to buy one used. I mean, that's another thing that's huge, because if you're going to go buy these old guns, I mean, you've really got to make sure that they don't have loose ribs and cracks off the tangs. And
yeah, you have the sort of the vintage buying 101 section in there.
You know, usable minimal wall thickness. I mean, so I got a whole chapter on that. So then in part three, I've had still a lot of different questions.
Okay.
I'm still getting a lot of questions on, you know, where to buy these guns and what's affordable. I'm getting people that want to hear more of my hunting stories.
Yep.
And I still am getting a lot of questions on, you know, the different gauges and,
yeah,
you know, what can I use my 28 gauge for and its limits and why. And then I'm getting a little bit more scientific, you know, questions on proof marks, and because people apparently are buying guns from other countries and needing to know.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I don't want to kill it, but I definitely am trying to get into some things I didn't cover in one or two, and I'm finding it to be kind of difficult, but there's always something to talk about with side-by-sides. And it's just in the making, very slowly. I got a friend that Billy wants to fund it. I've had some other really nice people give me some extra money towards writing a third book, so I kind of feel obligated to do it. I really do.
Well, hopefully if there's anybody out there listening that wants to nudge you, where can they go pester you about number three?
Yeah, so I do have a website. It is DougStewartAuthor.com. That's where I sell my books off of. They just pay with PayPal. Of course, both my books are on Amazon, but I got two different emails on there, and they can contact me directly through there and ask me questions. I got a gentleman that just asked me questions about, you know, Parkers and you know, they asked me some different gunsmiths they can go to that might be local. And so I want to address these things too, of course. So yeah, I really encourage people to read these two books, get educated, feel free to reach out to me right now with additional questions, because then they could actually still go into their third book.
Yeah, if there's anything they want to learn about or topics that maybe they haven't seen covered, get those into Doug's working project right now.
Absolutely. And I'm so glad that more people are hopping on the side-by-side and traditionalists. Instead of just wanting to go out in the field and be killers, I'm seeing a different trend now. I'm seeing people that are really respecting the land. They're going out there and they're enjoying and taking pictures of the scenery. They're really getting into their bird dogs, their guns. And they're starting to take, you know, longer trips and traveling, and it's really neat. They're enjoying the, you know, God's creation, and they're making more enjoyment out of it instead of just killing something.
Love it.
And I think that's cool. That's the beauty, because there is less game than there used to be. And some things are not like they used to be. So you can cherish just getting a few birds and making an incredible dinner with it and taking pictures of it and posting it. And like I said, sitting around the campfire and having a cocktail and laughing about the day's events and having a good time. And I do a lot of exploring, you know, and seeing the different countryside. And man, I see all kinds of other nature too, so I can tell you where to hunt other things.
Yeah. Hey, did you, I saw something, I was going to ask you this. Did you see there was a mountain lion kill in Colorado, like not that long ago, recently?
I did. And that's not too far from me. I live right at the bottom of that canyon.
That's what I was wondering. Okay. Really?
Yep, it's right up the canyon. Yep. From me.
Wow. Have you ever seen a mountain lion?
Oh, absolutely.
Really?
You don't see them very often. They're very
elusive. Right.
And one freaky time is many years ago in Nebraska, I was taking my little nephew before the sun came out to a deer blind. And we were walking, and there's just a little layer of snow. I said, "I'll take you out there, son. And I know it's a little freaky. There, you have nothing to worry about. The sun's not up. I'll take you out to this deer blind." Took him out there. We sat in there until the sun started to come up. And I said, "I'm going to walk back to my sister's farmhouse." I walked back, and about halfway, and in our footprints, a little trail we made in a mountain line, I walked right in our foot tracks and followed us half the way, I guess, to see what we were. And then, took off to the west off my tracks. And we never knew it. And I was like, that kind of sent a chill up my spine.
I would bet, yeah. Yeah, I don't, and I mean to like breeze over, like it was obviously a tragic thing. I think it was a like a 40-year-old woman. She was out hiking by herself and was killed by a mountain lion. And there was an article on MeatEater.com. But this mountain lions, I can't, they're like all over my radar right now because we, I just, there was obviously, I've never seen one. My odds are way less here in Minnesota. We don't really have them, but they can pass through here. And in fact, there was a mountain lion in Duluth. Within the last month or so, in fact, one day my where my two boys go to school, they sent out an email saying that the kids had to stay inside for recess because somebody spotted a mountain lion, and there was one that passed through Duluth, and I think they figured it was a collared lion from Nebraska that then moved on. Like I never really heard anything after that, but then I've been reading a bunch of thriller novels and fiction stuff, and I just read there's an author that he wrote a book called Cougar Claw, and it was about a mountain lion kill. And so I was just reading that, and then I went on and saw this article on Colorado, and I was talking to you, and so I just mountain lions are like at the top of mind for me right now.
Well, it is, interesting, and that stuff don't happen often, except
Right.
for because we'd had a guy get attacked by one a couple years ago in our mountains too, that was running a chainsaw cutting wood.
Huh. Wow.
But usually they're crazy and they're diseased,
Yeah.
and they're sick, and they're desperate. Okay, that's usually the case, not just a normal healthy one, or
Yeah.
if they're being real territorial with their with cubs or something,
Sure.
But generally, yeah. But we've had the dogs tree a bobcat, and I'm like, whoa, and there's a bobcat up there screaming at him up in a tree. So yeah, that you run into a neat adventure seeing other wildlife too.
Yep. Are you a big reader? And if so, what's the last book you read?
I was a huge big reader. I've got books everywhere, and I had a friend just ask me for some, and lately I haven't read anything. I haven't bought anything. I haven't read nothing. And I know that's bad, but
You're watching crime documentaries
I'm
instead.
watching crime, and I wrote my two books, and now I'm thinking about my third. And yes, I've reviewed and looked at some of my old books, and part of the reason I do it is I liked my own spin on it, and I don't agree on some of the old experts on everything. Does that make
Sure.
sense?
Yeah.
Like I see prejudices from some of the old writers that don't say, don't ever, shoot Damascus, and the end of story. And I'm just not that guy. I'll say, well, if you want to shoot them, here's how, here's what to look for. I think some of the best Damascus out there's made some incredible barrels, and there's plenty useful. But if you're gonna do it, you're gonna make sure, they're nitro proofed, and you're using the right ammunition, and I tell how to do it instead of just being biased. And you've gotten that in this whole conversation. I'm not biased on, barrel length or anything.
Yeah.
And there's so many authors that are like, no, if they're not 29 inches, I'm like, what are you kidding me? Everybody's not the same.
Yeah.
And all different barrels weigh different. So I just want to be more versatile and tell people, you're not wrong. Find the right thing for you. This is why there's so many makers and styles. And man, there's a lot of good shooters out there.
Yeah, there's something for everybody, that's for sure. How specific is your vision of wanting an old Toyota Land Cruiser? Do you know exactly which one or just an old Land Cruiser?
Well, that's a pretty good question. That kind of interests you, huh? So, I mean, obviously, right now, I like reliability.
Yep.
So, we have a Toyota 4Runner, and
Okay.
it's a trail edition, and I got differential lockers in it, and I got it super capable because I want the reliability. When I'm out in the middle of Montana, nobody's going to come save me. And we end up in some pretty rugged terrain. Well, me being an old traditionalist, I realize some of the really old 1950s and 60s Land Cruisers are really cool and rugged as crap. And I would have to say, somewhere between the 60s and 70s, I'm the most attracted to them. And I'd like to restore it. And I'm still going to make it capable and make sure it's got the lockers and enough ground clearance and stuff for what I do. But I'd be lo love to be hunting and putting around in that in the future.
Yeah. I'm definitely I'm the listeners know I'm a Toyota fan. I kind of dream about having a Land Cruiser, but I haven't been able to justify it from a practicality standpoint yet. But I'm not an expert on like the old, really old ones, the FJs and the Cruisers and that kind of stuff. But I've just always it's held a special place in my heart and mind, the Land Cruiser. And even when I see one driving on the road, doesn't matter what year it is, I'm just
Oh, you
always
don't
looking at
care?
it. No, I
Well, I
don't.
liked them up, and I mean, obviously, you got newer models, and I'm
Yeah.
such a traditionalist. I'm telling you about the old creatures.
Yep.
But up till about 97, I believe, they were still super capable, and they had differential lockers. And then they became more of a soccer mom's car after 97.
Yeah, from a looks and in luxury standpoint, they definitely went that way, but I don't really think they ever lost their off-road capability
They're
and
very
their
capable. Very, they're built
overbuilt
like tanks.
nature. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Big differentials are super reliable. And to me, that's got a charm to it. I know it's, I guess we're kind of a little strange, but.
Well, hey, we're talking side by side, vintage side by side sock shotgun, so I suppose that all tracks.
It does. It really does.
Well, this has been a blast, Doug. I really appreciate it. I'm glad we connected and we're able to catch up again. And sounds like you've had a great season so far, and hopefully are not done yet. So best of luck on any upcoming hunts, and hopefully you'll send me some photos from your upcoming trips, buddy.
Well, thank you very much, Nick, and God bless you, my friend.
Right back at you, my friend. Take care, and listeners know where they can reach out to you. DougStewartAuthor.com, right?
Right.
Okay, DougStewartAuthor.com. All right, buddy. Thank you. I appreciate it. That does it for this episode of the Birdshot Podcast. Thanks for listening, everybody. Hey, everyone. It's your host, Nick, here. One more thing before you go. Thanks for joining us on this episode of the Birdshot Podcast presented by Onyx Hunt. Be sure to subscribe and follow the show so you don't miss our next episode. And if you really love the show and want to contribute above and beyond what you already do by listening, you can do so by joining our Patreon community. Click the link in the show notes to this episode. You can sign up for as little as $5 a month. And if you do, I will send you some of these Birdshot Podcast can coolers and stickers as a thank you for doing so. Thanks, everyone. Catch you on the next episode of the Birdshot Podcast.